Hey there, this is Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searles, and this week, Dan Lynch and I talk with James Walker of Fission.codes. James is at the very forefront of like a whole bunch of different movements in code that are going to distribute the world for us. He's been in front of this stuff for a long time. It's really interesting stuff. He's really good. Everything he says, I think, is in final draft. It's brilliant stuff, and you got to hear it. That is coming up next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 681, recorded Wednesday, May 18th, 2022. Yes, you can. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by NetFoundry. Reinvent the network and eliminate the WAN by decoupling security from infrastructure to protect our applications and data with open source zero trust. Grab your free swag and free tier now by going to netfoundry.io/twit. And by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV has everything you need to level up your IT skills while you enjoy the journey. Visit itpro.tv/twit for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription when you use the code TWIT30 at checkout. And by Collide, that's Collide with a K. Get endpoint management that puts the user first. Visit collide.com/floss to learn more and activate a free 14-day trial today. No credit card required. Good morning, good evening, good whenever it is, wherever you are on earth. I am Doc Searles, and this is Floss Weekly. Joining me this morning is Dan Lynch. Are you there, Dan?
I'm here. Good morning, Doc.
For those, he's got his on-air sign, which doesn't have a light in it, does it? Does it have a light in it? It's over your left shoulder.
It does have a light in it, but it's not on at the moment. I should have it on, shouldn't I?
It looks like it, yeah. It suggests to me that you're on a drug called air. I don't know why.
I am, yeah. I most definitely am at the moment.
And we are about as far apart as we could be time-wise. You're in Liverpool, right?
So, I'm in Liverpool in the UK, yep, over in the northwest of England.
And I am in Kauai in Hawaii, which I think is 11 hours behind you. So,
wow.
I think we have humidity in common.
a little bit, yeah. I wouldn't mind betting the weather's better where you are, though, I think.
It is. It's cloudy this morning, but this is one of those places where if you don't like the weather, wait 10 minutes, it'll be different. Actually, over that way, about 10 miles is the rainiest place on Earth. You can't get a satellite photo of it. It's the middle of Kauai, this island, and it's bringing rain. It's got rain all the time. Yeah, this exists.
Wow, I always thought Manchester was the wettest place in the world. We always make that joke about Manchester. We have a Liverpool-Manchester rivalry that goes on. And It's a bit of a whole thing about they're the wet they, because of their position they get a lot more rain than we do, so we like to make jokes.
Yeah. So our guest this morning is James Walker of Fission.codes and much else. Are you familiar with what he's about and what he's doing?
Perchance. I have to admit, I wasn't until I listened to your podcast with Catherine actually that you did recently, relatively recently with James. Fascinating stuff. Yeah, really interesting.
So let's just jump into it. Before we get to our guest, I have to let everybody know that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by NetFoundry. Networking has traditionally been handled by dedicated teams and personnel. You could say network security has been deemed too important to leave in the hands of developers. One of our sponsors, NetFoundry, believes differently. Secure connectivity is too important to be taken away from developers and has forced dependency and stifled innovation and business velocity or unnecessary trades off security for those benefits. Therefore, NetFoundry created and maintains OpenZiti, that's Open Z-I-T-I, providing an open source, free and easy way for the world to embed zero trust networking into anything. It provides everything you need to spin up a truly private zero trust overlay network in minutes across anything. directly in your app or any device or in any cloud, built on principles of extensibility, flexibility, and scalability. Attacks from insecure networks can become a thing of the past. External network attacks, including DDoS attacks, brute force, credential stuffing, CVE, or zero-day exploits, PGP hijacks, phishing, and more, can be stopped. This is truly zero trust of all networks. No need for expensive and risky reactive patching. Agnostic design patterns ensure you only need commodity internet with outbound ports without needing networking engineering skills to implement it. Say goodbye to complex firewall rules, inbound ports, public DNS, static network access controls, and VPNs. Spring for Shell and Windows RPC RCE are recent exploits, CVEs. The recommendation is to cloud inbound ports, but OpenZD allows you to have no inbound ports at all. OpenZD was mentioned in Java Magazine about how they Zetified the Spring Boot for any Java app. Moral of the story, those who make themselves dark cannot be exploited by Spring for Shell or other network attacks. Eliminate the tug of war between developers and security. The former can work programmatically with software, while the latter have isolated apps driven by policy, visibility, and logs they require. Zero Trust is a journey to start wherever you need, based on your priorities. OpenZD offers numerous SDKs, tunneling apps for popular OSs, and edge routers in cloud marketplaces. If you don't want to host OpenZD, use the NetFoundry SaaS, including free forever tiers for up to 10 endpoints. Head to netfoundry.io/twit to grab some free swag, learn more, and get started. That's netfoundry.io/twit, and get your free swag and free tier today. Okay, so our guest this morning is James Walker. Very interesting dude. He's the VP engineering at Fission.codes. He's been contributing to open source for more than 20 years. He was a longtime core Drupal contributor, one of the first OpenID implementers. He did that for the Drupal project, and author of the original O status spec, which powered federation between StatusNet. He was very involved in that, and platforms like Mastodon, very experienced in that whole world, which we're still in and really need, and a really smart dude. So welcome to the show, James. How you doing?
Oh, I'm good. Thanks for having me, Doc. Yeah, this is a treat for me because at one point, twit.tv was actually a Drupal site, and I briefly worked at... I worked at the company Lullabot, whose founder also wrote the theme song for Twit. So it's fun to finally be on a podcast here. Yeah.
That's fantastic. I was thinking, do we have a theme song? I guess we do. I don't tend to think that it is. Now I'm probably insulted to it by thinking, I don't know what the theme song. But that's cool. Actually, I remember... Linux Journal ran on Drupal,
it did,
like from the very beginning, and still does. I mean, I'm not there, and Catherine and other colleagues here are not there, but it's kind of a placeholder site, but it's still running on the Drupal that Catherine maintained. So yep, that's, we hope to keep up with.
Yeah, that's how I met Catherine and got to know a handful of the people at Linux Journal was through their use and involvement in the Drupal community. So it's a fun circle completing here for me.
So you're in Toronto, right?
That's right. Yep.
I have that right. And
you were involved halfway between you and Dan this morning.
Between me and Dan. Yeah. And we were joking earlier, we could have an Earth sandwich where you're the Canadian bacon in the middle and Dan and I would have a piece of bread on the ground. So you were involved with, I remember status.net, or was it status.net? It was identica.ca. In the Canadian tradition, identity was all over the place. There were a huge percentage of Canadians involved in identity. And that was kind of successful, but we're all still pushing that same rock uphill right now. Mastodon's pushing that rock. Others are. Tell us about, kind of give us the arc of that story and where we are in that story now, because I think your work now is optimism in that direction, right?
I certainly think so. Yeah. So status.net, or StatusNet, the company, was the company and the team behind Identica, and ultimately, a bunch of other federated social instances. So this was back 2009, 2010. I had been doing a fair bit of conference speaking at the time, and I met Evan Perdomo, who also was based here in Canada. At a conference, and we got to talking and shared a lot of the same ideals, and I actually went and worked for him at StatusNet. And the big challenge was, if we want to do social networks that aren't giant monoliths, right, like the ones we still live with today, what does that look like? And so what we came up with was a federation protocol, that we called OStatus. It sort of morphed and migrated. So ActivityPub is the sort of dominant standard there for Mastodon and its similar tools. But yeah, the original one was OStatus. Evan and I and a couple other guys at the StatusNet team put together a spec. We did the initial implementation. We did some integration testing with other companies at the time. And I think, you know, it was successful in that the model lives on today. So StatusNet, the company, unfortunately, didn't make it. But the protocol and sort of the approach to federating social sites lived on. I think some of the things that we learned, so there's a lot of problems in trying to do social networking outside of, you know, the Twitter and Facebook, the sort of dominant players. But one of them was to run StatusNet. So StatusNet, our software was written in PHP. So you needed, you know, a web server with PHP. You needed, you know, a database, so something like MySQL. And that hosting requirement was a barrier to entry. You know, so our hypothesis was, you'd get organizations, maybe it was your company, maybe it was a community you were involved in, that would run these sites, which is sort of what we're seeing with Mastodon today. But even in that sort of world, there's overhead, right? Somebody has to maintain all that software. They have to keep the servers up. If you receive growth, right? So recently, Twitter's been in the news a fair bit. There's been another spike of people moving to Mastodon. And a lot of times they don't know better. They start at mastodon.social, which is the sort of the main Mastodon instance. And I remember seeing as the news was happening and they were seeing a spike of users, they were having to sort of scramble to scale that service, right? So even in a federated setup where you have multiple sites that are interacting, each one of those sites has some overhead in terms of needing to have people running the servers, people making sure they're up, people making sure the software is patched and is upgraded and there's no security vulnerabilities. And that's before you even get to the actual community moderation and anything like that. So what happens there is you start to see a bit of a burden. So a lot of you know, these federated social instances will kind of come, they'll get some attention, and then, you know, that sort of burden of maintenance means a lot of the instances end up dying off or going away or become unused. So that brings me to sort of today at fission.codes. What we're doing is putting together protocols, specs, and things like that, along with some working code that tries to do a bit of an end run around, you know, effectively the need for servers. So unfortunately, the serverless namespace has kind of been, it's taken. So we refer to what we're doing as local first edge apps. And so what we're looking to do is be able to run as much as possible for not just social apps, but any web application, be able to run that directly in your browser and use peer-to-peer communications to do interaction between devices.
So, James, really fascinating. I used to use Identica a lot. I was really, really into Identica, and I interviewed Evan Prodromo a few times for different podcasts and stuff. Do you know if anyone still uses the OStatus protocol? Has that been inherited by anyone like Mastodon or any of those sorts of apps?
Yeah, Yeah, so OStatus was actually where Mastodon started, and there were a handful of others. There's an Elixir-based project called Pleroma. That might be the first time I've said that out loud. I hope the pronunciation's okay. So OStatus was sort of where those tools started as StatusNet faded out. So the StatusNet project actually got picked up by the GNU project and got sort of rebranded as GNU Social. So those projects all started with OStatus. There are still sort of bits of it, like some of the projects haven't renamed some of their endpoints, right? So you'll still see OStatus in a URL every once in a while. The OStatus sort of standard transformed into what's called ActivityPub, and that's the sort of dominant spec for doing federation today.
Oh, excellent. It was great. I used to love denting, as they called it. It sounds strange in my British accent, I don't know. But when we used to dent instead of tweet, that was quite cool. So it sounds excellent. I've been researching or reading about some of the stuff that you're working on there at Fissions today. And I watched a video with your CTO, Brooklyn. She was explaining Web3, because we've had the web, obviously, and we had Web 2.0. Everyone remembers that. That was quite a big buzz thing for a while. And now we're on to Web 3. So what is Web 3? How would you explain it to someone if they'd never encountered it?
Yeah, I'll give you my definition, which may not be sort of the universal one. And in fact, I Fission as a team has started to drift away a little bit from Web 3 because Web 3 in sort of the popular media today has kind of become synonymous with blockchain. While we at Fission do some work with blockchain, like our core technology is not actually based on blockchain technology. Web 3 to me means largely decentralization. The common quip to that is, well, the web is already decentralized. Except that the way that we used the web, certainly through Web 2.0, where you started to have applications that had sort of this heavy server requirement, helped contribute to sort of re-centralizing the web, where the people who got to run the apps as apps grew were the people who had the ability, the capital, the people power to maintain these large services that need, all this cloud infrastructure that we've come to rely on. So for me, Web3 is breaking out of that. And it's not to say that blockchain can't or isn't part of that. But for me, and I think for us at Fission, it's not a requirement. So, the stuff that we're designing and working on doesn't actually need or require blockchain at all. But it is, peer-to-peer, decentralized. And for me personally, I have a strong desire and emphasis on user controlled data, right? So like, I want my identity to be in my control as much as possible online. I want my data to be under my control as much as possible online. And so we're trying to design basically a new way of building apps that respects all of that.
And what's the response been like from developers? I mean, because I imagine it's a slightly different way of developing, because if you're used to having all these big, big servers or whatever they might be, cloud deployments and all those things, a lot of effort seems to go into that, and a lot of buzz. There's a lot of buzz around in the industry about how you can have swarms, your Docker swarms, and all these things. How do people respond to that idea of running stuff peer to peer, kind of via the browsers and so on?
Yeah, so there's sort of two responses that we get. So one is, and I see jokes like this online all the time, that an individual or solo developer, I deployed my side project. All I had to learn was some front end JavaScript framework, some back end language, or maybe they used Node, and then I had to learn, whether it's AWS or Google Cloud, any of the cloud, I had to learn like these 10 technologies to actually deploy and maintain my service. So the one response that we've seen is, you know, people who are, you know, small teams or independent developers who are very excited by the idea of building apps that don't require all of this other infrastructure. The other response that we've seen, and probably where we have our most traction right now, is in, you know, in this broader Web3 space. So there's a company called Protocol Labs that are actually the company behind IPFS, which is a technology we can maybe talk about. It's pretty central to what we're doing. But they are, you know, as they continue to develop and grow sort of their ecosystem, they're looking at some of the things that we're doing, particularly around authorization and things like that, and our file system that we actually built on top of IPFS, and seeing value there. So we are, you know, I think we refer to ourselves these days as sort of like an applied research group. So we are, you know, very like deep into research and trying to invent new things, but we're also actually writing code and trying to make things that people can use. And so, yeah, so like Protocol Labs and actually the Blue Sky project, which sort of spun out of Twitter, it's now its own independent thing, adopted our authorization protocol called UCANS as part of their tech stack. They had a blog post recently, and they actually have a Git repo with an architecture document that lists that as one of the pieces there.
That's really interesting. I was watching, it's interesting how this stuff's become more kind of mainstream. I was watching just the normal television, normal TV over here. It might have been BBC News or something like that. And they had a story about how, it was only a brief story, but they were talking about how, I think it was Facebook and Amazon and some of the other big players are trying to move away from password logins. And I thought straight away, oh, it must be some kind of certificate, or, you know, I thought back to the days of OpenID and all those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. In your kind of position where you're trying to build these technologies and you don't want these big companies necessarily to control them, does that make you feel happy, or does that make you feel not sad, but a bit worried when these big companies come in and say, you know, we're going to take care of logins. Don't worry about it. We'll look after everyone's logins. Presumably that's kind of like a bit of a red flag to you.
Yeah. I can say my reaction is mixed. On the one hand, right, every time one of the big dominant players introduces a new pattern, you know, just based on their sheer volume of users, it starts to make a pattern familiar. So yeah, so our authorization system is passwordless. It's based on public-private key cryptography. And we've had with some early users this hesitation, right, around, but wait, I didn't set a password. What's my password? How do I log in? And so I think, you know, on the one hand, the sort of like positive look on some of that work is that it starts to normalize and familiarize some of the user experience patterns, right? So it makes it, you know, common so that people feel like, oh, this is okay. I'm logging in. I may, you know, probably don't understand what's happening on a technology level behind it. And if we do our jobs well, you don't need to, ideally. Mm. But it's okay that I don't have a password. I know that this is still secure for me. The flip side is, you know, there's a tension in this. I mean, this has been going on for a very long time. You know, I think the approach from some of those companies is a little different, right? Like they still want to consolidate, you know, like an identity provider, right? So Facebook and Google are two, if not the two biggest identity providers. So they still want your like account and sort of your home base, if you will, to be with those services. And then you're using those services to log in elsewhere. Whereas, you know, we like explicitly don't want to be in the middle. So one of the big, so with UCAN, our authorization protocol, the big sort of flip there is it's not based on an ACL model, right? So an access control list. It's an object capability model, which means there is no central server that you need to log into, right? Like it's public private key pair that's been generated on your device. It doesn't leave your device. And so there's no like fission server in the middle that it has to communicate to every time you try to log in.
Excellent. So it's fully peer to peer, which is fantastic.
Yes.
Yeah, that sounds great. I mean, I hadn't realized quite how much, particularly Facebook, just the experience I've had with that, wants to kind of get you to use it as a password manager. My mind was blown by that. I had a little while ago, my uncle phoned me, and he never phones me. I'm like the family tech guy or computer guy. So I thought, as soon as the phone went, I thought, hang on, what's this going to be? And he said, somebody's hacked my Facebook account. And I said, oh, that sounds bad. Sorry to hear that. And then we got to talking about stuff, and he said, but I can't get into my email, and I can't get into this, and I can't get into that. And I said, well, what are you talking about? And he said, I log into Facebook, and then Facebook logs me in to all of my other things. And I said to him, so you're telling me you effectively use Facebook as your password manager? And it turns out that's what he does, and he must not be alone in that. So it's really scary. I mean, that's exactly the sort of thing I would think that, for me, speaking personally, we would want to avoid, is giving, you know, one company all of our logins to everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, so I would love to tell you that for the last, you know, 20 or so years, this was consciously my mission. I sort of accidentally fell into a lot of this stuff, like so many mm-hmm. people do. But I was involved in the OpenID project, for a lot of years. And that was part of the goal as well, is that, you know, the single login, right? So using Facebook to log in everywhere is super useful, right? And even in sort of like mainstream media, there is the understanding now that passwords are somehow not great. And that comes down to, you know, we usually use pretty weak passwords. We often reuse passwords. We forget passwords all the time. They're not a great system. And so Facebook login, you know, and all of that is a nice user experience, right? I logged into Facebook, and that means I can go to all of these other places and just click, and I'm magically logged in. The downside is what that means, you know, and with a company like Facebook in particular, is now all of my activity online is effectively monitored, right? Because I have the cookie from Facebook that's allowing me to do, you know, the login and detect this, and now me as an individual can be tracked across everywhere I go. But in OpenID, you know, the original, and actually Facebook's current login came out of OpenID. I believe they've shifted to OAuth. But yeah, that it's, you know, that original idea was that you would have all kinds of identity providers, right? Like, again, as an individual, I could be my own identity provider. As a small, you know, company or organization or interest group, we could be our own identity provider and have that single sign-in experience without, you know, having to necessarily use a centralized service that we don't necessarily trust.
Okay, so I have a whole bunch of questions that follow on that. And but first, I have to let everybody know that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by IT Pro TV. It's important when looking for an online IT training platform that you're getting the most up-to-date content and certifications. So let me make that easy for you. Go to IT Pro TV. In fact, they just released a new course, CompTIA A+, Core 1 and Core 2 series. This course is designed for professionals who support today's core technologies, from security to networking to virtualization and more. CompTIA's A+ certification is an industry standard for launching IT careers in today's digital world. In this course, you'll learn about hardware operating systems, networking, security, and troubleshooting. We talk about how great IT Pro TV is, but here's a reminder why. They have 7 studios where they film Monday through Friday. Their courses go from the studio to their course library in 24 hours and are divided into 20 to 30 minute episodes for easy binging. They make sure you're prepared for your exams with their virtual labs and practice tests. The best part about IT Pro TV is that you can learn and get certified on your own schedule, and it is always entertaining. May is ramping up for summer, and so is IT Pro TV. They're focusing on Azure, and we'll have 2 free webinars this month for you to check out. What is Azure Bicep with Adam Gordon and Wes Bryan, available on demand. And on May 19th at 2 p.m. Eastern, All Things Cybersecurity with Daniel Lowry and John Hammond. Don't forget about your IT team. Check out an IT Pro TV business plan for your team today. Visit itpro.tv/twit for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription when you use TWIT30. That's itpro.tv/twit and use code TWIT30 for an additional 30% off for the lifetime of your active subscription. IT Pro TV, build or expand your IT career and enjoy the journey. So, James, this is, a lot of us have been on this journey for a long time, trying to decentralize or distribute something that is ironically entirely distributed to begin with. All of us are independent actors. And the David Weinberger and I in 2003 wrote a piece that's still up on the web called, you go to worldofends.com or net or org, I think, but World of Ends, in which we say that it's a world of ends. We're all ends. It's an end-to-end network. We're all ends on this thing. Doesn't matter if I'm on a cable company here in Hawaii and you're on a corporate network somewhere or you're on your own thing. We all have an IP address. That's how IP is supposed to work. And yet we keep centralizing everything. And I was thinking that you were talking about OpenID. And as you know, we have a conference called IIW. And IIW really began when Brad Fitzpatrick handed over OpenID and said, you guys run with this. I'm done with whatever his little thing was at the time. And I'm trying to remember that. What was that blogging platform he had?
Oh, I think gosh. He was at LiveJournal. Yeah.
LiveJournal. That's it. Yeah. So LiveJournal. He had something at LiveJournal. He had, and we ran with it. A lot of us ran with it. And then we ran with OAuth. OAuth came out of there too. And what do we have? You know, we have Dan's friend or uncle or whatever using Facebook for everything, right? And including all these different logins. And why do we even need to log into something? I mean, what the whole notion of logging in seems to me very external. Like we're always knocking on somebody else's door and presenting credentials. And I think, I mean, that does map to the world. We're always walking into stores and other people's houses, and those are domains, those are places, virtual or real, that we have a sense of who's in charge and all that. But we're independent actors, and I think we're stuck with identity itself as something where I have, you know, I have my driver's license, I have something that's given to me by the state or by a company that is going to be my ID, and it's not. Identification is nothing more than being recognized, right? Oh yeah, you have a ticket. You're over 18. You belong here or you don't. I mean, that kind of thing. I want to say, what learnings do we have so far on this thing? Because you're on the case. A lot of us here are on the case. SSI is totally taking off right now.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to filibuster here, but a friend of mine yesterday said, I know what SSI is all about, fighting surveillance capitalism. And it's not. It's not about that at all. I mean, it can do help with that, but that's not what it's about. He called it weaponizing identity, and I don't even know what the hell he meant by that. So how do you get past all these misunderstandings and, you know, and maintain the energy to move forward? It's a long haul.
Yeah, it is a long haul. And yes, as someone who's been, you know, involved in this for a lot of years, I've definitely faced my phases of burnout and sort of exhaustion. One of the reasons that sort of my work at Fissions re-energized me is we've switched the focus a little bit, which is not to say that your identity isn't important, because it is, but because our focus is on changing the way that people build apps, what's important in that context is actually authorization, right? So UCANS, which is the protocol that actually our CTO Brooklyn invented, is all about authorization. So it stands for User Controlled Authorization Networks. And the reason is when you're trying to build apps, what usually matters is this person or is this user agent actually allowed to do the thing that they're trying to do. So in terms of identity, we're actually just reusing DIDs, so decentralized identities, which is a W3C spec. So we use that as the identifying bit. And then UCANs are all about, can this person do the thing that they're trying to do? Can they write this file? Can they read this file? Or whatever it may be in the context. And to do that, as I mentioned earlier, right, like the predominant way to do that in the past is you have some sort of centralized server that says, you know, that basically somebody tries to do something, you check against the list, the access control list, do they have permission or not? And that can be like as an individual, are they part of a group that has permission, right? So this is the way like the Unix file system works. The sort of flip that we made to try to get us out of this constant re-centralization on the internet is to do authorization based on object capabilities. So the analogy that I like to use here is, you know, UCAN is like a ticket. So you go somewhere, say you're at an event and they're passing out drink tickets. You go, you know, to the host or whoever at the door and you get a ticket. And when you go to buy your drink, the, you know, the bartender doesn't need to go check with the host that you have, you know, that you're allowed to get a free drink. You have the ticket that says that you're, you know, you have access to a free drink here. So that's, you know, a broad sort of high level analogy of how UCANs work, right? So something, you know, a service or an app says, this DID, right? So this identifier has access to do these three things. And then you take that. So UCANs are an extension of JSON web tokens, right? So it's effectively a JSON document. And when you try to do subsequent operations in your app, you already have the ticket that says you can do that. You know, the hope here, right, to get us out of this re-centralization is that by not relying on the centralized server, right, which again, as we saw, you know, in the federated social stuff, right, like there's always a lot of overhead to running, maintaining, upgrading those servers. So if we don't need that massive server, right, like if we get a bunch of new people using UCANs, nobody gets a pager duty alert in the middle of the night that their server is now being overwhelmed, right? The tickets have been issued and people are just going on. The other nice advantage is this also works if you're offline, right? Which most services don't do because they can't phone home to see if you have permission. So that's, you know, I don't have a crystal ball. Like, does this finally do it? I don't know. But, you know, it's our approach, right? If we can take off some of the burden of having to have all this infrastructure to manage it, you know, and, you know, because our devices, whether it's our computers or our phones, are so powerful now, we can offload a lot of what we've been relying on big data centers to do to the edge devices. And, you know, like most people's, you know, phone in their pocket has all the power to do, you know, the bits of cryptography that we rely on quickly so that the user doesn't even notice and they can proceed. And if they go into a subway tunnel and lose connection for 5 minutes, their app still works because it's not trying to phone home anywhere.
Wow. I'm running around on the web while you're talking and, I'm going to get straight. The best place to look for UCANs is, I'm looking right now at ucan.xyz. Is that the right one?
Yep. I mean, it probably is. Yeah, so,
okay, good.
Yeah, there are subsequent links from there. So actually, when we did our last podcast on your other show, my team was actually in the background as we recorded, launching the new version of our homepage. Because like so many tech companies, our homepage you know, got to a place where it was no longer reflecting what we were currently doing. The current one does. And so if you start at fission.codes, we've got links to sort of all the different wild and fun things that we're involved in. But yeah, ucan.xyz is fairly young, but it's you know, the homepage for that standard. It has links to like the actual libraries. One of the guys on our team built a validator so that, you know, you can check and make sure that it's been constructed properly if you're trying to do development with this. And, you know, we hope to continue to grow that site as an information resource.
And you mentioned DIDs, and I just put in our back channel the W3C page on DIDs. And one of the things I've heard about DIDs, and DIDs are often discussed here and in other places, it's a hot new topic, is that there are too many different implementations of it. Are you in that? Do you have that issue, or have I heard that wrong, or what's the deal with that?
No, I think that's a fair assessment. We've done a little bit of interop work with a team at Microsoft that's doing Ion. But for our purposes, sort of to get started, we're using, so DIDs have lots of flavors. So we use DID key specifically, where your DID, like your identifier, is actually the public key of your public private key pair. So because of, you know, what we're trying to build on top of that, having that public key available, is important. So it means that we can do things like an encrypted channel. So going back a little bit to not having a password. So if I create an account on my phone and I want to log into that same account on my desktop machine, I don't have a password. I don't have a username and password that I can go plug in. So the way that you connect your different devices is through a process we call linking, right? So you open your phone, it shows a page. We have a QR code if that's useful, but you can also just open the page on your second browser. It opens an encrypted channel. So we already have the identifier is the public key for the device, right? And then we link, and then using UCAN, we can actually delegate authority. So the phone has these permissions, and we say, now, you know, we've assured cryptographically that this is, you know, this new device is being granted the same permissions. And so now your new device gets delegated all of those permissions that your original device had.
You know, it seems with every new collection of technologies, and by that, right now, I guess in the broadest sense, we're talking about digital technology plus the internet, which is everything up from ICs to this protocol we have, TCP/IP, for anybody in the world being a peer than anybody else. And it seems to me that we always need some centralization. There's some things that, you know, are best done by a big operation, right? You know, it's just always going to work that way. And it's especially necessary for things like, you know, mining and big retail and other stuff like that. And we need AWS. We need the cloud back there. There are things that can do that we can't do on our own. But it seems to me that there's, at some point, everybody on the distributed side, and I don't want to say decentralized because it still sounds like you're a little bit central. It's where we are all independent. I think that's kind of the angle I have on it. But we have all these people working on independence in different ways. Listening to you, I'm very optimistic. I didn't know much about UCAN. You mentioned it last time. It looks very possible that the amount of activity that's going on around DIDs and SSI is massive, although I get really concerned at how much of it is corporate and not about you and me, and then easily misunderstood, and then there are all these other distractions like the surveillance capitalism and the rest. But I'm wondering who else are you working with? What kind of other outfits do you kind of hook up with or something? Because there are like minds out there, but I'm wondering, you mentioned Protocol Labs. And maybe a place to go here is that we've often talked about IPFS, but you were talking about parts of IPFS that are useful. And IPFS seems to be a stable enough thing now that there's lots we can draw from there. So maybe we could go into that. I'm not sure. I'm sort of grasping at stuff here. There's a lot to cover.
There is a lot to cover. So IPFS, so where we're seeing adoption is actually in some of the Protocol Labs projects, because I think they're already like-minded, right? So it's usually easiest to start with an audience that already gets sort of your premise and where you're coming from. Obviously, like so many companies and groups of people, we have big dreams of actually changing the way that applications are built. Protocol Labs has a lot of the same sort of ideas in common, and we use IPFS in particular heavily. So we've talked a lot about sort of authorization and identity. The other sort of the next big piece that we've been working on is what we call the web native file system, which is take IPFS, which in itself is already peer-to-peer distributed, right? So I can run IPFS on, on a Raspberry Pi. I can run it, on all kinds of places on my desktop. And so using IPFS, which has some really interesting properties, and the one I'll speak for myself, but I think my team would agree. One of the things that we think is so powerful is the idea of content addressing, right? And so that means instead of pointing to, a specific, say, URL, right? So domain.tld/path, which would be a location address if I'm looking for, a cat photo, because that's what the internet's for. Content addressing actually is a hash of that cat photo itself, right? So what that means is it's like, it's globally unique. It's also sort of, you have an assurance as a user that I'm looking at the right cat photo. It hasn't been doctored or changed in any way, because if it had, it would have a new content address because it's actually a different set of bits. So that's really powerful in terms of making data transportable, right? So, one of the things that, has been happening as long as the web has happened, is the idea of sort of bit rot, or like what happens when somebody stops paying for a domain and all of a sudden everything that was at that domain, whether, company went out of business, it got acquired, somebody just let the domain expire. All of a sudden all of the stuff that was at that URL, whether it's blog posts or photos of cats, now is inaccessible, right? Unless it's been mirrored or copied somewhere else. So IPFS is super powerful, and this idea of content addressing is really powerful. But one of the downsides or limitations that we've identified is if you have the content address of anything on this network, you have access to that file, right? Because that is how you access the file, is through that content address, which makes it really hard to do things like private or encrypted files. So we've developed, again, another protocol. We have a white paper for it. We have some working code. We call it the web native file system. And basically that's layering on top of IPFS. So the data actually lives on the IPFS peer-to-peer network, but we offer an encrypted files system on top of that, right? And so this builds on our previous work, because part of the reason we use DID keys as IR identifiers is because we're generating encryption keys. So one of the things that we can do with those encryption keys is start to encrypt files on top of IPFS. So now we have a system where you can, have security that a user is accessing or has the right to access certain things. One of those things can be a file system. We can also use that public-private key pair to start to encrypt the files at rest on IPFS, which, again, is a thing that opens a whole new set of applications without requiring back-end servers, right? So in Web 2.0, in the common sort of use today, if I write posts or upload photos or whatever it is I'm doing on the internet, that is usually being posted to some cloud server somewhere run by some company. It's probably not encrypted at rest. So if it's, you know, if it's sensitive or private data, it's probably living in a database system or on a disk somewhere, probably in one of the major cloud providers' systems. So there's, you know, and I think the biggest thing is you don't really know or don't have a say in that, other than just opting to not use that service. So, you know, one of the things that we're doing is let's, you know, use IPFS because it's, yeah, I mean, I believe IPFS is around 10 years old. Like it's been there for, it's been around for a long time. It's fairly well established. And it solves that goal of this content addressable peer-to-peer network that we can sort of layer on top of. And so now let's start to add some things that makes it really useful for building apps on top of. So having things like private data, and then any device that I link that, you know, has the authorization via UCANs to access my file system, I can just pick up and all of, you know, all of my cat photos are now on this new device because it's come across the peer-to-peer network.
Wow, that is really, really cool. I like the sound of that. I haven't looked much at IPFS. I need to do more of that. Do you think that, I was just thinking about the so many devices that we have now, this whole Internet of Things. I've got a lot of friends who work in that kind of area. I believe they call it edge computing is the trendy term for it, I suppose. But this whole thing of having devices like a lamp that will turn on and off when I tell it to or when something else occurs. Do you think, does that create any challenges for you in doing your peer-to-peer kind of decentralized computing, the proliferation of devices and clients and things that you're trying to hit, if you like?
Not really. So, I mean, with peer-to-peer networks, so one of the big challenges with peer-to-peer networks is discovery, right? So we know, given a content ID, we know that this data exists out on the network, right? But there can be challenges, and particularly when you get into like private personal networks, which are usually behind like a NAT firewall, there's all kinds of you know, tricks and things that they have to do to discover where the content is. So if you have, like in your home, if you were trying to share a bunch of private data between devices in your home or at your office, right, in a location, they're probably going to do really well. They're on the same local network. It'll be real easy once they discover, oh, I have all these peers with a bunch of data. It actually gets really, really fast, right? So if you think about IPFS sort of similar to BitTorrent, those of us who, you know, remember using BitTorrent to download Linux ISOs, when the content is available and we've discovered it, then the downloads can actually be way faster than bringing it in from a like single source download. There are some challenges in that sort of long tail of content. So if I'm trying to get you know, maybe a cat photo that's less popular, that is actually, you know, maybe was added to the network, several network hops away, there can be a little bit of latency there. And that is where, so, you know, one of the things that Protocol Labs works on, the actual peer-to-peer, sort of underpinnings of IPFS is this project called libp2p. And that basically building and optimizing that peer-to-peer networking is that whole project's point, right? So we rely very much on the continued progress of that project, and then IPFS on top of that, which has a distributed hash table to do this. Like, I have a content address, where on the network can I get it, and make sure that that happens as quickly as possible.
Excellent. Are you muted, Doc? Nope, he's not listening. Well, I have got one more. I'll carry. Oh no, he's back.
I'm laughing because I'm writing mute here, and then to kill noise. Anyway, this has been a rapid hour, and I one last few questions before we go. But first, I have to let everybody know that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Collide. That's Collide with a K. Collide is a new take on endpoint management that asks the question, how can we get end users more involved? This is in contrast to old school device management tools like MDM, which lock down your employees' devices without considering their needs or even attempting to educate them about the security of their laptop. Collide is built by like-minded security practitioners who in the past saw just how much MDM was disrupting their end users, often frustrating them so bad they'd throw up their hands and just switch to using their personal laptops without telling anyone. In that scenario, everyone loses. Collide, on the other hand, is different. Instead of locking down a device, Collide takes a user-focused approach that communicates security recommendations to your employees directly on Slack. After Collide is set up, device security turns from a black and white state into a dynamic conversation. This conversation starts with the end users installing the endpoint agent on their own through a guided process that happens right inside their first Slack message. From there, Collide regularly sends employees recommendations when their device is in an insecure state. This can range from simple problems like the screen lock not being set correctly to hard-to-solve and nuanced issues like asking people to secure two-factor backup code sitting in their downloads folder properly. And because it's talking directly to employees, Collide is educating them about the company's policies and how to best keep their devices secure using real tangible examples, not theoretical scenarios. Collide, cross-platform endpoint management for Linux, Mac, and Windows devices that puts end users first for teams. That's Slack. Get endpoint management that puts the user first. Visit collide.com/floss to learn more and activate a free 14-day trial today. No credit card required. Visit collide.com/floss today. And right now you can get a goodie bag of Collide swag after signing up for a new trial as their way of saying thank you. Okay, James, we're down at the end of our hour here, and there's just so much to cover, and you've done such a good job. Are there any things that we have not asked that you could answer briefly in the time we have left that you'd like us to have touched upon?
Yeah. I appreciate the opportunity. I hope my enthusiasm for this stuff comes across. I think the sort of next exciting thing that Fission is up to, and so this currently lives in our two-person research department, but as a project we've codenamed Dialogue, which is our distributed database offering. So, you know, we have this sort of long-term vision, progress that we're working towards. And so it starts with, as most things do, right, identity and authorization. We work, from that to the file system. The next option is doing a database-like system that works in this, decentralized peer-to-peer world where, some or lots of participants in the network may be offline at any given time. It's a really interesting, hard problem. So on our blog right now, the most recent post is the sort of first public presentation from our research team around how they're thinking about solving this problem, what they're working on, and the sort of progress that's been made, the direction that it's going. Personally, I find that super, super exciting because it's really exciting because I actually am starting to understand some of it. But also it's someone who's come from the sort of centralized relational database, Postgres and MySQL world, trying to think about giving similar functionality when you have bits of data distributed all over this peer-to-peer network and those bits may not even be online at some times. It's a really fascinating, challenging, hard problem that they're doing really great work to come up with solutions to. So, that's like I said, that's currently in heavy research. So we don't have working code for that, but that's I think the exciting next thing that's coming from us.
Well, I think you guys are in the middle of the best place to be in the future of development. It's totally fascinating and totally interesting, and we're almost totally out of time. So we always close with a couple of questions, and they're simple ones. What are your favorite text editor and scripting language?
So I'm a longtime Emacs user. Sorry to the Vim folks. But I do have this weird dichotomy where I actually do a lot of TypeScript and JavaScript development these days. And Visual Studio Code is a fantastic environment for that. So I kind of span those two depending on what I'm working on. And in terms of language, like favorite, you said, huh? Because I definitely use TypeScript most commonly. I still really like Ruby as a language. I think it's fun. And I like a lot of the things, you know, just it feels fun to write Ruby code sometimes. TypeScript is probably my most common and in a way my favorite there.
Well, that's fantastic. And we don't get that many Emacs people. So I'm glad you're on that one, because it's
a fun bit of side trivia about sort of the Fission team. There's a lot of functional programmers. So our CTO Brooklyn is, a big Haskell user and a big, she was very prominent in the Elixir community. So she does a lot of functional programming. And so Lisps and schemes and things are, popular internally.
Yeah, there's historically, there's so many people who are like still Lisp lovers, one kind or another. It kind of shows in different ways. Well, thanks so much. This has been a fantastic hour, maybe even a little more. And there's so many times where somebody's going to run on, but everything you've said has been substantive, and it's so we really, really appreciate this. And you're giving us the time. Have you back.
Thanks.
Man.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been a treat. Like I said, long-time listener, first-time caller. So thanks for having me.
Excellent. Thanks. So Dan, how was that for you, man? That was pretty damn good.
Yeah, great. Really interesting. I think James is a really good speaker, he said about the enthusiasm. You could definitely feel the enthusiasm for the projects and what he's doing coming through. It was, as you said, we could have spoken for at least another hour, I think, but we don't have another hour, unfortunately. So we could have kept going for ages, but all the stuff they're doing over there. I had a look at the web native SDK, which we didn't really get time to mention, but for all the developers out there, I know there's many who listen and watch, go and check out the web native SDK and some of the stuff that you can use to start maybe developing some projects of your own using these tools.
Yeah, it's fabulous, and with the UCAN and the content IDs, I'd like to see if there's a Venn overlap between that and Picos, which we talked about here before, which is that's not about content, it's about things, but things have content, all that stuff. It makes me feel very optimistic about where we're going. So it's good, really good. So what do you got to plug?
What have I got to plug? Very quickly, I was talking about Internet of Things and devices and all that kind of stuff. So I think I mentioned it before, but I helped to organize an event in Liverpool called the Liverpool Make Fest. It's for makers and of all kinds. You don't have to make things that work with circuit boards. You could be making, things out of wood. You could be doing whatever. We get a lot of techie people there. We have people who design rockets and all kinds of things at the day, but it's coming up. It's completely free. It's on July the 2nd. So it's about 6-7 weeks away now. It's at Central Library in Liverpool. If you're in the Northwest or you're within traveling distance of Liverpool, then please do come along. It's completely free. You don't need a ticket. You just come along and walk in and check out all the cool stuff. So you can find it at liverpoolmakefest.org is the place to find all the information if you want to know more. Please come along. And I think that's about it. Anything else you want to know, you can always follow me on Twitter or go to danlynch.org, which is the kind of central hub for all that.
liverpoolmakefest.org. Okay, great. I'm glad. Mm-hmm. That sounds like fun. I wish I could be there. We're actually trying to find a way to get to the UK in later in July, so I'm not sure if we can make it work. But if we're there earlier, I'd see, like to see if we can make that happen too. So thanks so much, Dan. Thanks to everybody. This has been a great show. This is the part of the show where I scramble to find what's up next week. Holmes Wilson, another guy we had on the on the other podcast with Catherine, and Holmes is he's really interesting. So I won't say anything more about that. But Holmes Wilson, a name like a company or like a law firm. Anyway, smart guy. He's in Worcester, Mass. That's coming up next week. So be here for that. Until then, stay cool.
The world is changing rapidly. So rapidly, in fact, that it's hard to keep up. That's why Micah Sargent and I, Jason Howell, talk with the people making and breaking the tech news on Tech News Weekly every Thursday. They know these stories better than anyone, so why not get them to talk about it in their own words? Subscribe to Tech News Weekly, and you won't miss a beat every Thursday at twit.tv.